Hey, welcome to the latest episode of Shit We Don't Talk About, the podcast that takes on topics that need more open and honest discussion. Which means some of these topics are triggering, so please take care when listening, and I'll always give you a trigger warning. For instance, here's one. Every episode contains swear words. You've been warned. Make sure to check out the show notes, which include an accessibility transcript of the podcast and all of the links for our guests at shitwedonttalkaboutpodcast.com. Mia Voss. My guests are filmmaker Osagi Okurura of the Innocent Convicts Organization and Lynn Currier of Squeda Solutions. In this episode, we discuss wrongful convictions, the prison industrial complex, exonerations, the mistreatment of inmates, and what's being done to right these wrongs. Tune in. It gets good. Here we go. Osagi and Lynn, nice to see you. How are you two doing?
Good, thank you. Nice to be here.
Very excited, Osagi. Yes, very excited to have you here. Well, I was introduced to you through my friend Lynn, who got introduced to you just through a list of people to contact to talk about specifically what you are both doing. So let's dive into it. Osagi, tell me more about the Innocent Convicts.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here again. And my name is Osagi. My last name is Okurua. I'm joined with my colleague, Ms. Lynn Currier. She is an advocate fighting for innocent people to be released from prison. And she has worked extensively with the Massachusetts DOC to bring some of these guys back home. And she's currently working on two cases, which she'll be discussing with us shortly. And about the Innocent Convicts program is similar to the Innocence Project, how they work. And we, shed light on wrongful conviction cases and highlight the plight of individuals and their families who have been erroneously convicted. We also bring attention to their cases through documentary filmmaking. And recently, we started a workforce training program to kind of integrate them back into society by training them in different skills, so that way they're able to earn an income and also have something meaningful to do when they come back home.
Well, I love that three-pronged effect. So one, bringing attention to the cases. Two, solving the problem so that this is not going to be this continuous ongoing feeding into the system, and then helping them when they come back too. That's so important.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So Lynn, tell us about the cases you're working on.
Well, I have about six clients right now, but there's two that I'm working closely with Osagi on, and my company's called Squeda Solutions. We work very, very closely together, probably more than is healthy. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, we do a lot. We do a lot of conversations, a lot of texts and emails. But anyway, there are two men that were working hard on their cases. One is Jonas Francis, who should have gotten a retrial, but it was denied because of what I call the boys club. He had two Brady violations, meaning evidence was hidden and it was proven in court. And also the judge did not allow new DNA evidence that totally exonerates him and puts a finger on two other people that were at the scene. It's just unbelievable. It's shockingly corrupt. But anyway, we're working hard. We're going after, so to speak, the DA and giving him all the reasons that he should drop the case, because we have so much on him, and now it's going to be the court of public opinion that we're going to hopefully bring him home. We'll go to the press if he doesn't assess or drop the case against Jonas. So Osagi and I do a lot of stuff on the outside, so to speak. We're not lawyers, but we understand enough about the legal system and we work with enough lawyers and enough people where we know how to kind of work in a with them and in a parallel way to them to help get the support and the awareness through media and whatnot. And social media is actually a really has been a great thing to help, you know, bring them home and pressure DAs into doing the right thing. The other person is David Yard, who I just mentioned, who is in, he's in segregation right now because he's being abused behind the wall, which happens every day because he wouldn't become an informant. And so now he's being, he's filed complaints against the IPS officers, they're the quote disciplinary officers in the facilities in the DOC. He's filed complaints against them because they've really been harassing and emotionally and mentally abusing him. So now they've been filing false D tickets, we call them disciplinary tickets, to get him, to pressure him even more and punish him essentially for telling the truth about them. So David's situation is really crazy right now.
And dire and really urgent.
Yeah, it's right. It's pretty horrific. It's as bad as it gets. You know, I've been very worried about him. He's doing okay. He's a very strong guy. Very strong-minded guy, but if you're a fighter, if you're fighting for your life, if you're protecting your rights behind the wall or other people's rights, you know you get a target on your back. And
is that what
imagine,
it is too?
Yeah,
I can imagine. Yeah,
yeah. And what they and, do?
And did, oh, go ahead.
Well, just real
well, I was going to say. Oh yes, yeah. Go ahead. We're so excited to say what we have to say.
Yeah. But if you're a young person and you come into different facilities, they look at you as someone that they can maybe manipulate, you know, into being a confidential informant. And he's been incarcerated for 9 years since he was, I think, 21. So he's not that old yet, you know. And so they look at him as sort of fresh meat, like, oh, maybe we can manipulate this guy. And they also take guys that have some mental health issues that are vulnerable. And they think that they're malleable. You know, they can intimidate them, offer them, you know, just be able to sell drugs, which they do all the time, and different things that they offer them. So anyway, when someone is strong and ethical and they don't, plus it's dangerous to be, as you can imagine, informant. If someone's strong and doesn't go along with it, they get upset, you know, because some of these guys are very, very unhappy people, you know, kind of macho guys that couldn't make it as police. So now they're in the DOC and they feel empowered. So anyway, that's what's going on with David. And actually, I've got one new client last night that's going through the exact same thing as David. He's right in the unit with David. So.
And thank you for telling us his story. And I want to spell out his name if you're listening and just want to look him up right away. It's David Yard, WARYARDE, right?
Yep.
David Yard. Right. So, right. And I want to even pull back just a second on the bigger picture and you started with it right away. And I just see this common thread with all of this is the problems in the system itself, that this, how corrupt it is. It is not just a law and order in this episode kind of thing. I mean, it is just, it seems so prevalent. I was just looking at an article that came out on News One with a long, long list of people who have been recently exonerated, and in case after case, you see either problems with the DNA or with the witnesses or with tampered evidence, or like what you're saying too, of people really just breaking the law to convict someone wrongly of breaking the law.
There's one thing I just want to share quickly that it's a similarity in both cases that Osagie and I've been talking a lot about recently. And what I'm seeing is that I have three clients, probably four, but three clients right now who I would bet, you know, $1,000 or more were at the scene potentially, but with someone that was an informant. And what happens is when an informant, either someone's already an informant and the state is protecting them because they don't want them to get caught and they're valuable to them. So they go ahead and frame somebody else. And I'll explain quickly how I've seen them frame them. or they cut a deal because their uncle is a lead detective, which is in Jonas Francis's case. We know that the guy who actually had his DNA and blood on his clothes that they knew about the first night when they took the clothes. Anyway, the informants have a lot to do with it. They have a lot to do with it. And it's a very serious problem, because in David's situation, the other person that we believe did it, and we don't want to get too into it because these are dangerous people. You know, these are people that we should be somewhat afraid of. We're pretty sure that that person became an informant, or possibly was an informant. And 2 years later, he got mad because someone was telling a joke in a hotel room where he was with his buddies, and he killed the kid. So 2 years later, after David being framed for something he didn't do, the one that we believe did it, without any doubt, scientific evidence shows that it couldn't have been David. This guy goes out and kills somebody else's child. So, you know, the state needs to be held accountable.
It just seems so incredibly prevalent. And that also is a problem too. And I saw from a couple cases I was looking at as well, that there is just irrefutable evidence in many of these cases. But I mean, similar to, I'll just use it as an example, in Shawshank Redemption, like, sounds great. We know we have the evidence, but you are part of the system, and us extricating you from that system will cause them to shine a light on how many problems are with the system itself. Right. So that means there are people just languishing, and I don't mean in a good way, in prison, because it would upset the system too much.
Yeah. It's truly a boys club. You know, a veteran lawyer and I were talking 2 days ago, and when she found out that Jonas didn't get his retrial, which is just unbelievably, it's shocking. It's so bad. It's so blatant. You know, she just said, yeah, it's a boys club, you know.
Yeah. And they're going to fight. Unfortunately, they're fighting harder and harder now, the more they see the systems crumbling with people being freed as well. Talk to me about some of the statistics of, you know, the number of people who are wrongly convicted. And then also let's talk about race in this, because it plays huge into wrongful convictions.
Okay. So for the statistics, we believe over 2,000 people have been victims of wrongful conviction since early 90s. And about 300 or so of them have actually been exonerated through DNA. And the average number of years they spend behind bars is considered to be between 12 and 15 years before they actually maybe get fortunate to be, able to appeal their cases successfully. And it's happening in a number of cases that we've been reviewing, and prosecutorial misconduct has been playing a huge factor in these wrongful conviction cases. And like Ms. Lynn said, some people might be informant or, caught a deal with the police or the detectives in order to maybe get a reduced sentence or get some kind of incentive to provide falsified information just to send an innocent person to prison or to close that case, which happened in David Diaz's case. And let me give you just a brief synopsis of the case. That way we have an idea of what really happened in this scenario. So in 2012, October to be precise, David and three of his friends attended an after party for a Halloween event. And that was in downtown Boston, Massachusetts. So it was like really early in the morning, probably around past 2 a.m. So they go to this party, and there was a guy who eventually became the victim asking people where they came from. So David and his crew, they felt they weren't welcome per se, so they had to leave early. So they climbed the elevator, headed towards the train station, and the guy still, you know, accompanied them to the train, towards the train station. And before they could get to the train station, all five of them stopped, and you could see there was surveillance video capturing the guys walking from the apartment building towards the train station. So they stopped, were facing each other, and in just a twinkle of an eye, like in a split under 1 second, the camera turned off, and what you could hear were gunshots. And after about 1 second, the camera turned on again, and you will see the victim falling to the ground. So the key, you know, there was this pathologist report that someone had fired about 6 gunshots when the camera went dark. And the gunshots came from an individual who was close to the victim. And mind you, David was about 6 feet away from the victim, but the report from the pathologist indicated that the person who actually fired the shot, who we believe to be one of David's friends, was about 3 feet close to the victim. So this was what happened. The guys, they fled the scene, and David was arrested about 3 weeks later. Well, there was one witness who happened to walk his to be walking his dog at the moment the incident happened. He identified the individual who fired the shot, and he said the person wore a blue baseball hat, and David Yard was wearing a white hat. So in the video, you could see Mr. Yard in his white hat, and another individual who came from behind Mr. Yard wearing that blue baseball hat. Despite this evidence, the Commonwealth convicted David Yard.
Just that simplicity to it too. Like, yeah, and I read that he did has, you know, come forward with pathology reports, experts, video experts, all these different experts, and they still are not willing to see it because it was just so much easier. And it just feels like there's just this sort of this air of, oh, people are disposable if they don't have the money to defend themselves as well too. And that's just so interesting, especially with it having surveillance video. And I wanted to ask you too about if we could bring up also like bail. I know bail is a huge reason why people stay imprisoned or incarcerated. I think of the story of Khalif Browder, who was kept in New York and just literally was never even guilty and just kept in for, I think, 3 years or something. It's really a quite a tragic story of, and that was because of bail and just certain circumstances. He couldn't get out of, couldn't get out of there. Do you also, that's obviously part of your work too, is discussion with people of bail and then representation, right?
Yes. So representation is very critical, but only a very small number of people are actually able to afford competent counsel, especially when it comes to the post-conviction review process. So I think we want to, you know, believe that the state needs to do more by maybe providing some kind of incentives for more lawyers or attorneys to want to be involved in this post-conviction review process. And that way can speed up the rate at which people want their cases to be revisited or to be ultimately dismissed.
That's really a great point too, of like the post-conviction or the, you know, conviction, and then, like you said, more the after part of like really trying to get them either rally to get out early or to, but the exoneration piece is huge too, right? There's the, maybe they can get out, but then, you know, you walk out with absolutely no money. You've lost your skill set for the last 10 to 15 years or not even been able to build any whatsoever. That to me is also incredibly heartbreaking.
It is.
I mean, and even Lynn, once these two gentlemen are out, with God willing and any heavy big spirit willing, there still will be a lot of reparation work to be done, which I know is also a piece of Innocent Convicts Project too, to help people with that. That's a huge piece because the stigma and shame has got to be tremendous.
Yeah, and it's also in a really basic way. Prisons have been research has proven it's really a common sense, but prisons, they take out people's ability to be able to really think and operate for themselves, so to speak, you know, to make just simple decisions like scheduling their life and all of those really simple things that we don't even think about, that we developed, those skills we developed since we were young, have been snuffed out, so to speak, you know, when people have been in prison, especially after, you know, 1, 2, 3 decades. So, you know, I went to an event with someone who actually was a parole hearing with a bunch of people that had been exonerated. And one of them was profusely sweating because his anxiety kicked in. And another one, his leg was just shaking as I was sitting beside him. And it just was heartbreaking to see what they go through. It's like, it's so out of their control because nothing's been, you know, and these are men that were exonerated after 38 years.
Oh, I can't imagine. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the conditioning of that, and it's so out of their control because they've never been in control.
No,
or they haven't been. You're policed by time. And again, just that's heartbreaking to hear about David too, with what's going on in his current condition as well too, because people do not want the biggest thing about old boys clubs. And I'll just say it, old white boys clubs, I'll put it out there, is that they just do not want to see that. So that is their bread maker. That is that is where they get their bread and butter from, is the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, you know, with David's situation, it's very interesting because, as I kind of alluded to before, it doesn't make the DA's office look very good if we can prove that this person is an informant or was an informant. Now he is in prison for God knows how long, but they don't want to make their whole office look bad. The only thing that David might have in his favor is David's case was being looked at for possible exoneration, and then it just magically sort of went cold, so to speak. It just sort of drifted off. And DA Hayden would probably look better if he said, oh, look at, you know, my predecessor blew it, you know, dropped the ball, covered it up, whatever he would say. You know, that's why we need the press involved in all this, because that could actually be a feather in his cap. It could be the opposite effect, you know, but often it's exactly what you're saying. It's a good old boy club and they don't even hide it. You know, they really don't even hide it. It's disgraceful.
Oh, it truly is. And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I would love to see him pitch it that way. Like, please, you know, even if it's for his benefit of like, right, look how bad this guy is. And again, this article that I was reading that was detailing case after case after case. And there are definitely some ones where there was a corrupt detective that but it resulted in it like 15 different exonerations of cases that they could. Yes, I'll send it to you. It is just incredible. But again, that's where you see this system that needs to be reconfigured at the very least. And we're talking, I mean, there's wrongful convictions, there's nonviolent and violent as well. And one thing I've always been aware of is certainly when it comes to the cannabis world and any kind of drug convictions. I mean, how incredible that is of how much quicker it is for white people to not be convicted, I'll say, especially when in these nonviolent, but you know, the drug convictions and so forth. That's a whole other world that's just huge as well, right?
Mm-hmm. There's something, if you don't mind, I'd like to kind of interject that I sort of started thinking about and wanting to express to you, and I'd let it slip, but I just want to share this because I think that the public needs to be aware, especially when people get on juries. And I've talked to jurors. I've got 3 different ones that I've dealt with. That one helped flip a case last year, and I have 2 hopefully they're going to flip Jonas's case. But what they do, this is what they do, and what we have to be cognizant of is it's not the cops that run these investigations. It's a district attorney. So the buck does not stop there, and that's where everyone focuses on. The DA knows exactly what the cops are and are not doing, and they know what the state troopers, if they bring them in, are and are not doing. They all work together. So I encourage people to go after the DAs in every situation, because it's all of them. It's not just the cops. But what I found in these two cases, for example, well, actually all of my cases, what they do is they, instead of doing the basic investigation 101 of getting the DNA off the victim and the other people that around it are suspects, instead of getting full ballistics reports that show the angle of the shots, you know, things that will scientifically prove whether or not it was one person or another, they purposefully do not either even do the that part of the investigation, or they keep it out of the courtroom. And what they do is they bamboozle the jurors. The jurors that I've dealt with, they are livid. They feel so bamboozled, because it's haunted them to have these young guys sobbing and going off to prison for life. And then they were a part of it. But they, yeah, I mean, they with this one case, Jonas's case, it was a vicious, awful stabbing of a bunch of guys just mauling this guy that Jonas had nothing to do with, but he happened to be in the parking lot at the time. And they took about four of the guys, including Jonas, and the victim's clothes to test. In what world do you not test them with DNA when there's blood all over everywhere? Like, this is literally what they did. So the jurors are now finding out this, and they're livid, because they're like, I said, well, what did they tell you in court about DNA? And they said, well, they said it was really confusing, really vague. And they mentioned a couple cars that they had tested. And they did mention that there was no DNA or blood in Jonas's car. But she said, other than that, we had nothing. His lawyer was really weak and didn't go up against, you know, this thing, this machine, so to speak. And she even told me that the lawyer at the end was really, really just stifled and frustrated. And the judge was frustrated with the lawyer and said to him in front of the jury, you know, you got to give me something, like give me some evidence, give us something to like ponder, you know, to contemplate about this case that shows maybe he's innocent. And the lawyer literally looked at him and said, well, you know why I can't. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! If y'all could see my face, like that is.
See it. Oh, they can't.
That's some dastardly shit right there. God dang, that's like a movie scene, and I bet. And how interesting, Lynn, that you. I love that you're talking to jurors, and that's
me too. It's fun.
Right? I bet it's like a Jenga puzzle of just figuring out what people are saying. And that really does add that. And thank you for that clarification. This is the kind of information I know helps people on the shit we don't talk mm-hmm. about of or shit we don't know about. Like right. we only see it in this one lens. And I think that's so interesting too. I've talked about this a lot. We just finished up with the election cycle this week to kind of put a time frame to the day that we're talking. But I really do encourage people, and please add to this as well, of taking a look at who is in your local election. I just spent a lot of time this weekend. I live in Denver, looking at some of the school board people. Like, I don't have kids. I've never looked at school boards. You know what I mean? But it's these things like they really are also a hotbed of where things are happening in the education system. And then looking at your DAs, absolutely, your attorney generals, your local sheriffs, see what their record is. I mean, mm-hmm. unfortunately, well, don't be lazy people. Do some homework and start looking. And I literally, there's a site that I look at too, that shows what anybody that's up for election in the legal system, what their records have been like, and like what their rating is with the citizens, what their rating is with other attorneys, especially judges. Mm-hmm. There's a lot. And I live near Aurora. And so unfortunately in this last week, the final police officer was not convicted in the death of Elijah McClain, which has just been absolutely devastating to our community here as well, because it's now, I believe it's, he was killed in August of 2019. And a lot of us didn't even hear about it until George Floyd started coming up, you know, those of us who weren't paying attention. And so, yes, I mean, even looking at the sheriff and the judge in this, it's been very disheartening. So there's a lot of power in who you and in your vote, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Paying attention. Well, tell us some other things that we can do. Give us some action items as well, or just some like what we just talked about, things you can look at and pay attention to.
I mean, Ms. Lynn already said it, like the DA is caused the shot here. So we got to, as you rightly said, you know, pay attention to who we are voting into these offices, mm-hmm. and be able to hold them accountable when, you know, flaws of this nature, of this magnitude happen. Because when someone is wrongly convicted, it's not only that individual that is affected. The family is affected. Their mothers are devastated. They've lost everything, like every penny they ever made goes to litigating a case where, you know, it's not supposed to be litigated in the first place. And there's one case that happened in Texas. His name was Timothy Cole. When he was wrongly convicted, his mom had to put her home up to get a mortgage in order to pay for or to bond him out of detention. So his mom was a teacher. What do you expect a teacher to make that kind of money to bond her son out of detention? And the bond, I think, was about, they said it for about $50,000. So a teacher in America with other children, you know, trying to fight hard for her son who was wrongly convicted to be exonerated. Yeah. So
there's so many stories like that.
It is very devastating story. So I think we should pay attention to the people we elect into office, hold them accountable. And I think law enforcement should do more like proper investigation of these cases and not just rush to judgment, especially when they see people, you know, black and brown people. Yeah.
It's very true. Go ahead, Lynn.
I think too, and this is something Osagi and I've done for a while, and we're ramping it up, but when there are campaigns like what Osagi's done, what I've done on social media, and whatnot, it's really important that the average person who hasn't been involved, that just believes in justice and is not accepting racism as a way of life or classism, because we know it's poor white folks as well, people basically that might not have as much access to money and power, so to speak. You know, it's gotta be public. Everything's gotta be put out in the public. And I always stop short of making myself and my family unsafe, because some of these characters, I'm quite honestly, I'm probably more afraid of one of the DAs that we're going up against than I am the people that actually did the murder, in one case, because they deal with people that would murder somebody in a heartbeat, because they have, you know, they're not the best characters to be working with the state and getting paid. I don't know. They might even get pensions for all I know, these informants, but it's like, and after someone becomes exonerated, they need to keep fighting and making that public. Like, we do the Innocence Project, the Innocence Program. We're very, very, very public. We're out on social media all the time, have events all the time. You know, I put out faces, and Osagi too, you know, we put out photos so people feel connected to these guys. You know, they're not just some faceless name, you know.
Statistic.
We talk about them like David is a father. He's a young father. He wants to go home to his kids, you know, like, and I'll tell you, I've had people, I have 5,000 friends, whatever, on Facebook from all over the country and some internationally. And I've had people making calls for my guy that I helped flip last year from across the country, complete stranger. He reamed out the DA. The DA called up our lawyer and said, "What's going on? All these people are calling us. And who's this Lynn Currier?" You know, and I'm laughing, and the lawyer, we're laughing. She's acts like she doesn't really know me. We talk all the time. And he said, "Yeah, and this guy is so-and-so. Do you know him? He says something a little bit threatening." We're like, "Oh, shoot, you know, yeah. Oh, shit."
Don't do that. Don't threaten people, you know, you can be for him. Yeah. Right.
We were like, "Oh, we don't, thank God, and we didn't know him." But of course, my guy was like, "Yeah, that guy was dope. Huh? He was gone."
Yeah, loving it. Yeah, those are my kind of people. Those are the people I'd be like, "Give me the hand, hold my earrings in my purse. I'm gonna join in with you on this too." You know, but you know, back on that point real quick, that's such a weird point of that they are doing business with informants.
Yeah.
It is
a career.
It's a career. Oh my God, you're right. They're like, they probably get pensions. Like, oh.
You probably get holiday pay and, you
right,
know,
right, rental. Right. Pay time off, PTO. Oh my goodness. But I love that. That's, I'm going to end with that and maybe a couple other, if you have any other calls to action. But it really is one, speaking out, sharing out. We were talking about the power of social media. It really can be an incredibly powerful and positive tool for change, mm-hmm. because of awareness. Mm-hmm. So sharing things out. All right. Yeah. Any closing thoughts? And then I have one more question for you.
I mean, I would just say that, you know, for people to look for the name David Yard and Jonas Francis, because literally in the next 4 weeks, we're going full throttle on social media. You know, and mine is my name. I don't even go through my organization, which I probably should, but I've gotten such a large following with my name, but it's just Lynn Currier. And Osagi Innocent Convicts, you know, to just check our Facebook friend, you know, friend request us if people are hearing this and they're as outraged as we are about this. It's something they could literally do right away to help. It could be that one phone call that was the one that broke the DA and said, okay, enough is enough. I've been flooded by 30 calls today, you know, 50 yesterday. And it could be that one call that pushes them over. So.
A lot of squeaky wheels out there, you know, and they hate disapproval ratings. It's a lot of ego out there. All right, I'm going to ask each of you, do you have a favorite swear word or phrase that you use a lot in the trenches? Let's end on a funny, positive note.
Osagi, don't tell her mine. Okay, be quiet. Just talk about yours, Osagi.
Oh. I'm not allowed to. Video.
Because you're not allowed to.
No, I plead the fifth.
No, he doesn't swear. He's a good Christian boy.
I was going to say, that's why I said our encouraging phrase, if you want to do that. Yeah, I'm on the swear campaign. Obviously, this is a podcast that has a swear word in it. So, you know, my brand is out loud and proud with that. So what about you, Lynn?
Oh my God. Well, I Osagi, what's
you don't want to hear, you don't want to hear. Oh God,
no, you have to hear it.
You know, what's beautiful is he's so polite, you know, being from Nigeria, he's very, very polite with his mm-hmm. elders. And he's like, Miss Lynn and Ma, and you know, mm-hmm. and then I get wound up and I start dropping F-bombs and whatnot, you know, because it makes me so angry. And I stop and I go, Lynn, you're an elder. You're not supposed to talk like that. You're supposed to have this calm. You know, and I'm like, but I think it gets other people wound up too. Osagi's probably sitting there with his fist in the air, but he's calm and cool.
Right. And I think it's like, a fun combination, actually. You know, it's the where the like, watch Lynn pop off over here.
It's, you know, I have to tell you really quickly too. The cutest thing is when you talk to guys behind the wall, they're like Osagi. They swear with each other. I'm mm-hmm. sure. You know, I know they mm-hmm. do. They never will swear in front of you as a woman. They are so polite. And then we're like, me and other women activists are, they're like you. We have our favorite word, our words that just kind of come out of our mouths.
Right,
and then I get off the phone. I'm like, oh my God, I just swore like a sailor, a drunk sailor. And this guy's like, yes. And yes, it's really concerning. And it's really disturbing. Yeah, we're not happy. They never swear.
Meanwhile, in your world, you're whispering or yelling, what the fuck, about every, you know, every 30 seconds. So I love that. Thank you for indulging me with that question. I really appreciate it. Absolutely. I appreciate you both so much. So I will have all the links in the show notes and of course on social media so you can follow them and get involved. And I appreciate you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. You can check out the show notes and guest links at shitwedonttalkaboutpodcast.com. If you like this episode, please subscribe and give it a like or leave a review, especially if it's a good one. See you next time. Bye.